In Galatians 5:7, Paul kind of continues that point from Galatians 5:4 as far as being severed from Christ. He reminds them, 5:7, he says, you were running well. Then he asks the question, who hindered you that ye should not obey the truth? When you look at Paul's writings, you find that he did oftentimes use illustrations from the athletic world. In our day and time, even if people are not really sports enthusiasts, sometimes when it comes to the Olympics, they will want to tune in, they'll want to watch at least some part of that. And in the ancient world, they had different games, and those were certainly things which appealed to people, sometimes to participate in, sometimes to watch. So we've got that kind of imagery in the Corinthian letter, 1 Corinthians 9. You see it over in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. You also have it not only here in Galatians 5, but back in Galatians chapter 2. Paul says there was a time when these Christians had been running well. That, of course, would be expressed with the ongoing tense. In this case, it is the imperfect tense. It had been true for a period of time. They'd been baptized into Christ, Galatians 3 and verse 27. They had been abiding in Christ. We saw that back in the previous verse, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 6. For a time, their faith had been true. Their love had been sincere. Their works had been good. But sometimes, even like the Beth athlete, what happens sometimes? You know, you're out there, you're doing well. Maybe you're watching your calories, you're watching your weight, you're watching what you eat, you're watching your workout times. But what happens sometimes when people, let's just take a diet, for instance. Here's somebody, they've dropped 20 pounds and they're looking fit and trim, and then you see them 6 months or a year later, what do you find?
You gained a weight back.
All right, and maybe they not only gained all the 20 pounds back, but maybe they picked up, you know, 40 pounds or 50 pounds. And kind of like that we had a sermon a couple weeks ago as far as what happened. And that's what Paul is asking here. What happened? He says that the Galatians, what's the key word here? Middle of Galatians 5:7. Who did what? Who
hindered
you? Now that's an interesting word. Anybody have a different translation? Something other than hindered? I'm going to take that as a no. The idea there is to cut in, to make an incision, to hinder. If you can imagine being out on a racetrack, you're running, you're in an athletic contest, and you have somebody dart in front of you. I mean, they just cut right in front of you. Well, we could use a car illustration, but it's more, I think, in the athletic imagery. Let's look at it from both perspectives. What happens if somebody cuts in front of you?
You lose your stride.
Well, let's think about it from a car perspective.
Well, you get hurt.
Well, okay, you might get hurt. You might be injured in an automobile wreck. What else might happen?
Get angry.
Well, you could have an emotional reaction. You could get angry. But what might happen to your vehicle?
You might press the brakes and lose control.
Yeah, you might lose control. It might be slippery outside, or you might end off the road. All kinds of things can happen. If you take that and you apply that to the athletic image that we have here, somebody darts in front of you as you're out there on the racetrack. I mean, you're giving it your all. You can see the finish line, and all of a sudden there, you know, as the finish line is in sight, somebody cuts in front of you. What might happen to you?
You could fall.
Well, you could stumble. You could fall. What else might happen? I mean, if it's really bad.
Lose the race.
Yeah, you lose the race. You end up off the course. And that's what Paul is saying to these Galatians. These guys, these heretics, the apostates showed up. The Galatians, they were running well. They had their eye on the prize. And these fellows, they just kind of cut in. They just kind of dart in like the person on the track or the car, and then all of a sudden it sort of knocks them off track, and he was not very pleased with that. So these Christians, they kind of make a spiritual detour. One source said the Galatian Christian army was marching at a rapid rate when old Judaism blocked its point, and that's a good expression of the point. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more? All right, let's move down a little bit. You have here kind of an interesting thing. He says, you were running well, and when he says, who hindered you, what stands out about the word who? Yeah, you wonder, because that would be the singular. It almost sounds like, we know from a little bit, some other sections in the later, we'll give you those references a little bit later, but there was more than one. So why does Paul say who's singular? It could be that he's talking about the ringleader, and it's interesting that he doesn't ask who the person is. Maybe he knew the identity, maybe he was unconcerned about that. Perhaps he was trying to focus attention on what the apostates were doing. But it does make it clear as you look ahead a little bit. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 8, he's going to say in that 8th verse, these heretics, these people who were trying to knock them off track, they were trying to persuade the Galatians. You're going to see in verse 10 the word trouble or something similar. They were troubling the Galatians. And then as you move ahead a little bit more in verse 12, he's going to say that these heretics, they unsettled these Christians. These folks were a real problem. They were a significant influence for bad. When you think about life, we find that in today's world, people still have some hindrances when it comes to the spiritual life. There are a lot of people, you think about, for example, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, evil companionships corrupt good morals. There are a lot of people that can lead us astray, sometimes morally, sometimes doctrinally. You think about family ties. Can they sometimes pull people away from Christ? Can family be a hindrance to the Lord? They can, especially if there is religious disagreement. You can take a lot of heat. You can get a lot of flack. People will say, well, we just don't agree with your church or with your interpretation of the Bible. What about a job? Can that be a spiritual hindrance for people? How would work, employment, be a hindrance possibly?
The environment you're in, what age you have.
Yeah. Here's a person, they're around foul language all the time, that finally rubs off. How else might work be a hindrance to the gospel of Christ?
Long hours.
Yeah. Somebody says, I'm just too tired to do anything when I get home. I'm just whipped. And that's understandable. So possessions will pull people away from God. You have false teachers, as we have here in the book of Galatians, and sometimes it's just not putting God first. I want to point out some things as far as some spiritual truths, at least six from Galatians 5, 7, but we'll stop for hands, and Gary will begin with you.
A lot of times people will say, what hindered them? But he said, who, which puts the blame really on a focus on someone.
Yes.
Instead of just like a general concept or whatever.
Yes, and as you think about that, that certainly has some application. There are people who hinder us for various reasons. Sometimes the people closest to us, sometimes perhaps an enemy. I don't like him, I don't like her, and folks allow that to bleed over into the spiritual life, and it becomes a hindrance. Tim, to you.
Kind of where he says, who did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? It kind of makes you think that maybe the person that was doing the hindering was doing that on purpose to keep them from the truth.
Yeah, they were. They probably had good intentions, but it turned out that they were not headed in the right direction. Adam?
And it could even be that the who that he's referring to is them themselves. He said you ran well. So if you run well, what's hindering you? It's not a what, it's you've hindered yourself from obeying mm-hmm. the truth because you know the truth, you ran it well.
Yeah.
And now you're just letting someone lead you astray. That's your own fault.
That happens with a lot of people. They know better. People will sometimes admit, we knew better, but we did it anyway. And there is self-hindrance. Anybody else? All right, Galatians, Mom?
I'm just going to say, mostly with young people, a lot of times they do things just to stay in the crowd or stay popular.
Yeah. Peer pressure will sometimes be great enough to cause people. I mean, we know as far as Peter slipped back in Galatians chapter 2, he gave in as far as no longer eating with the Gentiles. That was a huge problem for him. Exactly right. All right, Galatians 5, 7, at least six important spiritual truths from there. First of all, when Paul says, you should not obey the truth, does that tell us that a standard of truth exists? It does. In our world today, people don't always believe that, but there is something which is called truth, and you find that several times in Scripture. As you look at that objective standard, it's referred to in a lot of different ways. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 2 says, it is the gospel of God. It's the gospel of Christ. We saw that back in Galatians 1 and verse 7. Acts 2:42, it is the apostles' teaching, the faithful word, Titus 1:9, the pattern of sound words, 2 Timothy 1:13, and it is the faith, Acts 6:7, and Jude 3. So people today sometimes say, well, what do you believe? And people may say all kinds of things, but one proper answer would be, we believe the truth. We believe the truth exists, and that's a standard that we want to follow. All right, a little bit more as far as an additional point there. If the truth does exist, then would it be right to say that we're free to believe whatever we want, at least if we want to be in a right relationship with God? We're not. I mean, people do have the right in this country to believe whatever they want and, by and large, do whatever they want as long as it's not criminal activity, but God says there's going to be a consequence for that. There is truth, Galatians 5, 7. Second point that we want to make, if people want to please God, again, Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 9, what does the end of Galatians 5, 7 say? That you need to what? You need to obey the truth. The truth is something which can be obeyed. And that, would you like to guess in the tense? Past, present, or future. You need to obey the truth in the future. You have obeyed the truth. Or you need to obey present tense of truth. All right. It's going to be ongoing. It's going to be expressed and is expressed with the present tense. Some do what seems persuasive, and that's what was happening with the Galatians. They had been persuaded by these people. We see that same problem occurring today, oftentimes with the young. They are persuaded to do what is popular, what's trendy at the time, God says, don't live your life in that way. You obey the truth because it's what is right. It's because you follow it because it's what is authoritative. If truth exists, what does that also imply as far as an existence? If truth exists, then chances are there's also going to be
non-truth.
All right, or another way of describing that non-truth would be
a lie
and error. There would be a lot of different ways to express that. Religious error is called a different doctrine, 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 3. It's referred to as the commandments of men, Titus 1 and verse 14. Peter is a little more forceful, 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. He describes it as destructive heresies. And Acts 20, 29 and 30 talks about perverse information, profane babblings, 2 Timothy 2:16. Paul over in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1 refers to it as the doctrines of demons. If you have demonic doctrine, how bad does that sound?
Bad.
That sounds pretty bad. You don't want to be involved with that stuff. And God says if you're not involved with the truth, these are some of the things that you're believing and following. Back in Galatians 1 and verse 9, Paul referred to it as a different gospel. When you look at Galatians 5, 7, and this perhaps is not as forceful as the other points, he says, who hindered you that you should not obey the truth? Do you get any sense that God is displeased by those who would lead others astray from the truth?
Yes.
And that could be done in a lot of ways. In the morning lesson, we'll talk about kids being deceived in some various ways. But there are different ways for people to lead folks astray when it comes to the truth. We know from Romans chapter 16 and verse 17 that apostates can cause division. In that case, religious division. God was not pleased with that. Paul talked about the spiritual rot. It was going to be like gangrene over in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. Let's think for a second about the truth that we have in Galatians. What was one of the big things that the false teachers wanted the Galatians to do? Anybody remember? It was a physical act.
Be circumcised.
All right, be circumcised. Now, in the grand scheme of things, how big of an issue or how big of a deal does circumcision seem to be? I mean, major surgical procedure or minor surgical procedure? All right, it's going to be in the minor category. I mean, it's not going to lay you up for 6 months, anything like that. And, you know, you would look at that and you think that really doesn't seem to be like a big, it doesn't seem to be much of a big deal, right? You know, circumcision, uncircumcision, who really cares? So even though it was, from our perspective, a relatively small thing, in God's eyes, it was what? It was a big thing. Sometimes small issues, and we'll talk about this a little bit later as far as an illustration or two, a small deviation is something which comes with fatal consequences. The final point is whether or not we believe that Jesus is enough. The Galatians, as they were being influenced by the false teachers, and this is a really crucial point, they were not being told by these teachers of error that they had to abandon Christ. They were not being told that they had to forsake Christianity. It was just that Christianity, as the Bible describes it, wasn't enough. They also needed circumcision, and they needed some other elements of the Jewish law. And then if they took these things from the Old Testament and brought them over to the New Testament, and they combined them, then they would be complete. Then they would be mature. Then they would be truly pleasing to God. Some things just don't mix. And that's true when it comes to Christianity. God says, I've given you the system. Add to it. Take away from it. You're messing with it, and I am not pleased, even though it might seem like a small deviation. We want to make sure that we've got book, chapter, and verse for what we do. Stick with that, and don't mess with it.
The circumcision, like you said, is kind of a smaller act, but really it's almost like what you call a skenectomy, I think.
Yes.
Because there's a whole bunch attached with it, and that's just kind of the representation. And you could say the same thing about baptism now. Like, yeah, it's a small thing, and it gets you wet for a little bit, but what does it mean? Is it really just that minor that it doesn't matter, or does it?
Yeah. And that's true. It is a synecdoche, the part for the whole, that once you take a little out of something, when it comes to Christianity, that affects some other things as well. I mean, there's just no way to say this is a small part, it doesn't matter, and we're good. Adam, were you going to flash a hand or not?
No.
Okay. I thought there may have been one over there, Tim, and then maybe Don, and then Brian.
That's one of the devil's best tricks, is presenting half-truths.
Yeah.
Because he convinces people that what he's telling them is on the up and up, but really half of it's a total lie. And once he gets them sucked in with that half that's the lie, they're pretty well lost.
Yeah.
And you don't realize it.
The devil is a master packaging. I switched to sermon illustration today. I did take a picture from Dairy Queen a week ago. That's where I had lunch with some people. And as I walked in, there was a sign that was looking for employees. And there were three or four things, and the top thing was, if you work here, you can be a Blizzard wizard. Doesn't that sound good? You can be a Blizzard wizard. And I mean, they made it sound great. Like a wonderful place to work. And I'm not saying it's a horrible place to work, but I'm just saying Dairy Queen compared to some other jobs, where would you rate the job? Probably not the one that you want to retire from, right? But they make it sound so good. And that's exactly what the devil does. He packages stuff. It either looks so good, it may not all be false, it may just be bad for you, or you have half lies, and once you unwrap it, then you begin to see just how awful it is. But we do find that in life, that people will package things in the best possible way, and it's sort of surprise when you finally open the box. Don, did you have a thought or not? I didn't want to omit you. Brian, to you then.
The phrase obey truth is odd to me. It's almost like you could believe truth, but it's, you have the same with obey the gospel. The gospel is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. It's like how you obey a statement of fact. There's something that's true. It almost seems like it's just the belief of that, or living in accordance with the belief in that, would be obeying it.
I think when you look at the word truth, wouldn't you take that perhaps in a broader sense as far as what we have in the New Testament?
And it may seem like you need to, because obeying a true statement, how you obey a fact.
Yeah, I think you're looking at a body of doctrine. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at what we've got in Galatians 5, 8 through 10. He says, This persuasion didn't come from the one who called you. Who do you think the one who called them was? Yeah, it was deity, God. A little leaven leavens a whole lump. I have confidence to you word in the Lord that ye will be none otherwise minded. But he that troubleth you shall bear his judgment, whosoever he be. All right, there was this persuasion, there was this influence from the heretics, that's expressed with the present tense, and that refers to the apostates. When someone is trying to get another person to do wrong, do they normally ask one time, or are they persistent?
Persistent.
Yeah, it's just like, come on, you know, we've talked to you, this, you've always said no, and we've been doing this for a long time, it's never been a problem for us, come, this time we finally need to make it happen, those kinds of things. Well, Paul says that these false teachers were not of him. Again, that's a reference to Christ, of deity. And then, of course, as was rightly noted, that it was deity that had called them. In other words, the error of justification that was being bandied about at Galatia, this was not something that had come from God. It was not something that was associated with the truth. And if they got involved with it, as we saw earlier last week, Galatians 5:4, then, of course, they would be lost. Anybody remember how God calls people? 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 14, he calls people through the word, or the word gospel, depending on your translation. Verse 7 uses athletics to condemn the false teachers. Here in verse 9, though, we have a different illustration. Paul turns from things like you would find out in the racetrack to what? He's now talking about?
Loving bread.
All right, cooking, baking bread, all those answers would be correct. Paul said a little leaven, a little yeast does what? It leavens the? Hold on. Why do you think he used that illustration? What was he saying?
He's talking about spreading the word.
Okay. And what kind of word was being spread? Good or bad?
Gospel. Good.
What? No. He says a little leaven leavens a whole lump. You think that he's using that in a positive way? I mean, we would use that in a positive way as far as baking bread. Do you think he's using this positively or negatively?
Negative.
He's using it negatively. And what's his point? Well, let's ask another question or two. What do you think the lump is that's being leavened?
Sin.
No?
Christianity.
Well,
their church.
Yes. At least the one congregation in Galatia, perhaps all the churches in this area. That's the lump. And who's leavening that lump? Who's leavening the church? The good guys or the bad guys? The bad guys, the apostates, the heretics, these people who are trying to bring the Galatians under at least some aspects of Judaism for justification. Remember what we saw back in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 30? Let's go back there at the end of the chapter. He says, howbeit what saith the scripture, cast out the handmaid and her son, for the son of the handmaid shall not inherit with the son of the free woman. That was a discussion about Hagar, Sarah, Ishmael, Isaac. And Paul said that old system, it's got to be cast out. You got to get rid of it. And then now he says here, leaven is leavening the whole lump. Gary, to you.
That illustration was pertinent to Jews because of their history with
bread
that was required to not have leaven in it, right?
Yes.
Because a little, even, you know, they would clean their their houses really well, mm-hmm. make sure there was no leaven in it when it was time to make bread.
Yeah, they were zealots as far as checking every nook and corner from what we know, trying to make sure that there was zero leaven. Very good. When you think about the influence of leaven, you begin to see, I think, just how destructive the false teachers and their false teaching was. There's an interesting passage back in the book of Zechariah. Brian, you want to go back there for us? Zechariah chapter 4. We'll take a look at Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 10. And that passage is going to make the point that small things, even though we may see them as insignificant at times, and that certainly could be true of a congregation, a lot of times what's small is mighty. You ready? Zechariah 4 and verse 10.
For who has despised the day of small things? For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line and the hint of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth.
Okay. The day of small things. What's the key word that's used there in association with that? There are some people who do what? They despise them. There are some larger congregations, they may not say it openly, but they despise smaller congregations. It's like, hey, you know, we're 500 and you guys are 5 or you guys are 50, what can you do? We've got all of our works and look at all the great things that we're doing for God. And, you know, you're just actually heard a preacher kind of despise some smaller congregations. Well, yeah, there's smaller folks over there. You know, and that's sad that people will depreciate somebody because of size. What happens with the acorn? What's it become? That puny little acorn. Well, it does become a tree, but what kind of tree?
Oak tree?
All right, it becomes an oak tree. And you look at the oak tree, big or not?
Big.
Yeah, it is a very large tree. And yet, if you were looking at just the seed that it comes from, you would be thinking, well, that's not going to be very impressive at all. What about the person, especially in our day and time, picks up some kind of contagious, foreign, deadly disease and comes back to the U.S., enters into a city, large city, and around people, go to a place like Los Angeles, place like New York, out there spreading the germs, spreading the disease around, and what happens soon?
Pandemic.
All right, you've got a pandemic. You've got a whole city infected. So it's just one. How can he make people possibly sick? How can he do or inflict great damage on a city? So a little leaven sometimes does leaven a whole lump in a lot of different ways. One source said moral and doctrinal error like yeast and cancer. Again, cancer is a great illustration. Somebody gets a little cancer, it's just a spot. Have people died from just that spot?
Yeah.
I mean, it spreads, and sometimes it's a very aggressive form of cancer. Back to that quote. Moral and doctrinal error, just like yeast and cancer, will spread undetected. The only remedy is vigilance, followed by immediate purging or surgery. And that's what they had to do. Paul recommended a similar thing at Corinth. It would have been possible if this had not been stopped, that if there was just one congregation, this could have affected all the congregations, and it could have literally destroyed the Lord's church in this area. I've said it before, but God, as you look at how he set up the church, how did he arrange for leadership in the church? Do we have one headquarters and from there everything flows down, or is it structured differently? Yeah, and what's the structure?
Each congregation's
autonomy. All right, autonomy, local leadership in every church. We know that from Acts chapter 14 and verse 23. How does that help us when it comes to religious error? Yeah, you might have in a state, maybe a certain section of the state, north, south, east, west, and 10 congregations there. One congregation really goes off the rails, but if that congregation is only being guided by local leadership, what about the other 9? They could still possibly not be affected by that or not be affected by that to the same degree. But if you've got, for example, with the Jehovah's Witnesses, you've got the Watchtower organization, they pretty much control all their groups. And if you infect one, you infect everybody else. Anything that you want to add or ask, we'll take a couple hands. Tim, I saw you first, then Adam, we'll go to you.
You might have a relatively new preacher or a relatively new elder that you don't really know that much about. And they may have in their doctrinal
positions?
Yeah. Thinking they may have some ideas that are, you know, contrary to what the word says, but you won't know about it until after they've infected the church with it and caused churches to split, caused churches sometimes to just go out of business, so to speak. I mean, that happens. It has happened. And so that you have to really watch that.
Yeah, and that would be another way to apply a little leaven leavens a whole lump. If you have someone who is in some kind of position to teach, and it could even be with young people, and they are teaching what's wrong, that influence in almost every case, is going to spread. And it's going to affect some people. And it has, in some cases, destroyed some people spiritually. And as you said, ripped apart churches, sometimes closed churches. It's a serious thing. And maybe that's why James said, I think it's 3:1, be not many of you teachers, because we're going to bear the greater judgment. There is a heavy responsibility there to make sure that you handle the truth accurately. Adam?
I think that illustration, the yeast leavening the lump, is such a powerful one to me. Growing up, there was always those goofy sitcoms where someone who's not very good, never been able to cook, and they're trying to follow instructions, and the cook calls for like a teaspoon of yeast, and they accidentally put a tablespoon because they didn't realize there's a difference or whatever. And then they pull out of the oven, and this giant, huge thing because of how much it has an effect. And I think that's something that we can think about in our lives today, because there's so many, like, sometimes just little things. Or somebody says something, and you don't really pay it any attention, but it stays in your mind, but and gets your wheels turning in your brain, and before you know it, you know, it's dug itself in there, and it can make a huge difference, something so very insignificant. I think that's something, as far as it goes for us today, when we're looking at this this text, is that, you know, we do need to stay watchful of sometimes the little things. I see it especially with my littlest one. When she gets in trouble and she's in timeout, then her brain just is going 9 miles an hour. Next thing you know, while she's in timeout, she's done 4 or 5 other things that she wasn't supposed to do because she's just been sitting there with her wheels turning.
If somebody needs to create a fill-in sermon sometime soon, this might be a good idea to explore. A little leaven leavens a whole lump, because you could look at it positively, or you can look at it negatively. Paul's using it negatively, which is kind of why we're focused on that. But building on your comments there, building them out just a little bit, it also applies in a positive way. As Christians, I mean, we talk about being a light to the world, and that is a little leaven the whole lump. It's really the same principle, only that's looking at it from the positive perspective. You think about the moms in homes where, you know, the dad is an abuser, maybe involved with drugs or alcohol, and the mom is trying to be that bright spot in the home, trying to be that leaven. It applies in the home. It applies in the workplace. It applies to young people in school. And, you know, our ability to leaven, it may not seem like it is significant, but we do have an influence. And it can sometimes do some great things that we just don't see. It is a very, as you said, powerful principle, negatively as well as positively. And as a Christian, we certainly want to try to avoid the times where that would be negative. Somebody else flash a hand or not? Okay, let's see where we go next. I got another quote here as far as the yeast illustration. One source said this should be death. It should be the downfall to doctrinal indifference. But many still imagine that a little deviation from the truth of the gospel will do no harm, and to those who hear them. Those who now boast about their doctrinal differences, inclusiveness, cannot reconcile that belief with Galatians chapter 5 and verse 9. And that's right. You start introducing error, and at some point you're going to just get further and further out. I had a Facebook discussion with somebody. In fact, he writes a lot. Younger guy, and I think he'll probably outgrow this, but it was a Facebook discussion. He was proposing the idea that we have closed communion in the church. Closed communion, if you are not familiar with it, basically says that if you are not in good standing, quote-unquote, then you don't get communion. If you are a non-Christian, you're forbidden from taking communion. And I said, you know, how would that work? And I asked some questions that he just didn't answer. But I tried to point out in that brief discussion that if you embrace that, which I argue is an error, you start out with something that's small. And then, you know, can you imagine that? This was something that some congregations actually did back in the 1800s. And one of the ways that they tried to figure that out was the elders would go to the various homes of the members and figure out who was worthy. If you were considered worthy by the eldership, you got a token. And if you had a token, then you, of course, were entitled to have communion. Well, isn't that a little bit of a problem? I mean, who's worthy? Nobody. So if you're going to say it's only for the worthy, guess what? You can just eliminate that from the service. And then, you know, I asked another question. I said, all right, you know, just as a for instance, and he didn't like this one, But I didn't intend for him to like the question. I said, what happens? You know, you've got, for example, a 17-year-old boy who comes in to the Sunday morning service. There is a girl who is immodestly dressed, and the young boy engages in some lustful looking. Now, because he had taken the position after some of my questions, he said, well, if it's a private sin, you can be worthy. If it is a public sin, you're not worthy. I said, fine. I mean, if that's the standard, he kind of changed the standard from day one to day two, and the second day we wrapped up the discussion. But anyway, I said, if that's the standard, then you got this young fellow who comes in. It's obvious, you know, that he's guilty of lust. Now, you can probably eke out a confession before worship service, but how are you going to know if the guy has repented? So is he on the approved list that day, or is he on the you can't take communion list that day? So again, a little leaven leavens a whole lump. Once you open this up to some error, you just start having to, it's like a leaky ship that we talked about recently. You patch this hole, and then you got another one, and you got another one, and you got another one. You don't have that problem if you stick with the truth. But if you don't, you have all kinds of issues. All right, we also see Paul's focus on the one who troubled these saints. When you look at the word which is translated troubled or something similar, you're going to see that in about the middle of verse 10. That is a present tense verb, and that word means to disturb. It means to cause restlessness by words and false teaching. They were really stirring these people up, and Paul said that that person was going to bear his judgment. Now, the word bear is interesting. It describes the bearing of a heavy weight, which will pass or press down upon those seeking to impose a load of Judaism on these Christians. That word's used to describe bearing or carrying a lot of things in life, from sandals, everything to Jesus' cross, John chapter 19 and verse 17. A little bit more, and then we'll stop and see if there's something that you want to add or ask. When you look at verse 10, we have the three key parties in this letter. Paul talks about I. He says I. That's referencing himself. He's got you, the Galatians. And then he says he. Now, I told you a little earlier that I would show you that even though Paul uses the singular here in Galatians 5 a couple times, we know that there was more than one. Let's go back for just a second to Galatians 1:7. He says, which is not another gospel, only there are some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. That tells us for sure that there were some other folks. It was not just one. And then in the same chapter that we are in, Galatians 5:12, he says, I would that they that unsettle you would even go beyond circumcision. There were multiple people. We don't know exactly how many. It may have been a small number. That could be perhaps tied in with a little leaven leavens a whole lump. Maybe that's also what Paul was saying, that it was not a huge group of people. But even though he focuses in the first part of Galatians 5 on a singular individual, there were multiple people, and they were all condemned. Anything that you want to add or ask before we go down to verses 11 and 12? Okay, let's see what we've got there again, Galatians 5. He says, but, there's a contrast, but I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why am I still persecuted? Then hath the stumbling block of the cross been done away. Would that they that unsettle you would even go beyond circumcision. Well, of course, the apostles were teaching the truth about circumcision, that it was no longer necessary. That was not being taught, however, by the apostates. They were saying that circumcision was required. Paul then asks this question. He says, but I, brethren, the Galatians, he says, if I still preach circumcision. Notice that word still. I think that's a King James translation, or perhaps yet. Maybe that's in the King James. ASV has still. He says, if I still preach circumcision. What does that word still or yet tell us? If I'm still stealing,
ongoing.
Well, kind of.
Used to.
Yeah, at least that used to be something in the past. So if Paul says, but if I still preach circumcision, what's that tell us about his past teaching? Did he teach circumcision in the past? Yes, he did. When would that have been? All right, when he was following the principles of Judaism, he didn't understand the truth about Christianity. So Paul admits, look, there was a time in my life where I would have agreed that this was the correct practice. But he says, he wasn't doing that now. He says, if I still preach that, the implication is he's no longer doing that. He asks this question, why am I still what? Why am I still persecuted? It would be like somebody saying, well, let's look at it this way. If somebody is released from jail, they have done their time, and they've been released, and they're living right, and the police begin to rouse them. The police show up on the door. What's the person probably going to say?
I've done my time.
Yeah, and why are you here? You know, there's no reason for you to keep checking me out, because I'm on the straight and narrow. I'm done with that way of life. And that's kind of what Paul is saying here. Why are you persecuting me if you think that, you know, I'm still teaching this stuff as far as Judaism? Well, how do you think the people who were making these accusations against Paul, how do you think that they were possibly having some success against him? What do you think that they were able to say? Why would they say that Paul was still preaching circumcision? Well, I think if you go back, remember what happened with Timothy? Acts chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. He was going to be working with Paul on some evangelistic efforts, and it may have been that they were aware of that, and they said, oh yeah, Paul, he still preaches circumcision, at least sometimes, because he had Timothy circumcised. Paul refuted that accusation by asking why the persecution that he was receiving was ongoing. There was no reason for him to be persecuted if he did believe that circumcision was necessary for salvation. If he was teaching the same thing as the heretics, then the apostate should have had what kind of attitude towards him? I mean, if you're teaching the same thing as somebody, is there any reason to oppose you? No. I mean, you should be on the same page. You should be friends. You should be co-workers. And that's kind of Paul's point. Paul was not teaching circumcision, and that's why people, even throughout the book of Acts, followed him and persecuted him. Okay, a little bit more as far as what we want to say here. Paul knew and said on more than one occasion that the cross was looked at in what kind of way? He says in verse 11b, he says, then hath the, what of the cross been done away? The?
Ceased.
Well, before that, what comes before the word cross?
Offense.
All right, offense. Some of the translations would use the word stumbling block. If you were to look at the original word, it would look a lot like our English word scandal. Why did the Jewish people find the cross of Christ, the message of the gospel, so offensive? I mean, Paul makes it clear over in the Corinthian letter, 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 23, that Jews were offended by the cross. It was offensive to them. They heard that and they thought, that cannot be right. Why would the Jewish people have that attitude towards the cross? Adam?
Old Testament talks about cursed is man who's hanged upon a tree.
Yeah. I mean, and you're saying that this Jesus, he was not just a good guy. Who was he? He was the Son of God. He was the Messiah. He was deity in the flesh. If you were a Jew, again, you can understand why they probably would have just thrown you out in your ear. I mean, that would have sounded to them about as silly as anything. Any other reasons?
Well, what Jesus represented was the end of their way of life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can go back and look at the genealogy, which they were fond of doing, and it was generation after generation. Our grandfathers, our great-grandfathers, great-great-great-grandfathers, they were all part of Moses and the law, and you're telling us that we've got to throw away our history. You think that's going to be a tough sell for some people? It's going to be hard. So that helps us understand, to some degree, why the miraculous gifts were given. Believing that the Messiah was crucified was a hard, hard truth. When you go back and you look at the word which is translated cross, it described a stake, a pole, to which criminals were nailed and left until death ensued. I want to give you that definition again, and think about that in terms of what we just said. The cross described a stake, a pole, to which criminals were nailed and left until death ensued. It wasn't just that Jesus was crucified. He was crucified in a way which was reserved for who?
The worst of the worst.
Slaves were sometimes crucified, but this was the way for a criminal to be crucified. Can you imagine that? You know, the people right now, we'll see whether or not Trump is indicted. But I suspect that there are going to be some people who might vote for Trump. But if he's indicted, do you think that having someone who has been indicted for a crime, perhaps even spent time in jail, you think that's going to be a hard sell for some people? I think they're going to say, we just can't vote for somebody who has been, you know, confined to jail or perhaps prison. And you have kind of a similar thing here. If this Jesus is such a special character, how could he have died in this kind of way? I mean, he went and experienced capital punishment. What about when we think about our day and time? As far as the cross, the gospel, Christianity being a stumbling block for people, do we have some stumbling blocks when it comes to the truth in our society? Why do people find Christianity objectionable?
On their toes.
Yes, and some specific illustrations might include what kinds of things?
Well,
gambling.
All right. There would be some social sins where you would look at those activities and say they don't line up with Scripture. That's not going to fly very well with some people. Tim, do you?
Well, I mean, all of those things, drinking, gambling, illicit sex, the way people, some people, the way they make a living, because what they do, some people, what they do for a living is just crooked.
Yeah.
And they don't want scriptures stepping on their toes and ruining it for them, which it does.
The wide way is a lot more attractive.
Yeah.
Any other thing come to mind as far as why the gospel is so offensive to our culture?
Because there's an absolute...
Yeah. Our Bible tells us that there is a specific way of doing things, and it's not just recommended. It is either this way or it is death. And that is not what our culture wants to hear. Our culture wants to hear that everything is fine. Even sometimes some criminal activity is fine. You do whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want, with whomever you want, and you are good. God says no, 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 and no. And society does not like that message. I don't remember who the founder was, but he said our Constitution was written for a moral and religious people. That's true. We did have that in the minds of many way back when. We have lost that, and we're suffering some of the consequences for that. Brian?
Another thought is the pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Mm-hmm. The independence that doesn't really jive with the sufficiency of Jesus' sacrifice.
Yeah. I'll just tack on to that, that people have their own religious ideas, and a lot of times what they find is very different from Scripture, and the idea that you've got to follow the Bible instead of the traditions of men, the ideas of men, it's not going to be very, very popular. People want to believe that just about everybody's going to be saved, and they're turned off when they hear something else. Anybody else? Tim?
Says there's an absolute truth, and society, the majority of society, says just the opposite. There's everything we do is in a gray area. There is no absolute truth, and that's less, more than likely propagated by the devil. But that's how society lives.
Yeah.
And so that gives them a license to do whatever they feel like doing.
Yeah. Absolute truth doesn't exist unless it affects me personally in a bad way. Then, of course, we're going to say absolute truth. We'll take Adam, you, and then Don, and then Gary.
Yeah,